Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? Dennis Clausen is a professor of American literature and screenwriting at the University of San Diego in the USA. He's a highly respected, award-winning author of many works of fiction that reflect his lived experience and special interest in American small towns. He's also written Storytelling as Art and Craftsmanship, offering practical strategies for screenwriters and creative writers. The emphasis on storytelling as art and craft is critical. Dennis also writes regularly about the threat of artificial intelligence and technology to our thinking skills, neurological development, mental fitness, our imagination, having an authentic voice, and questioning whose soul will be in literature. I first discovered Dennis Clausen via the magazine Psychology Today. His article posed the question, are the humanities in a war for survival? Dennis was speaking directly to questions I also raise in this series. The survival of arts and humanities from cuts and subjugation to technology is critical, especially when we understand their role in cultural identity, representation, social cohesion, democracy, well-being, and more. When I invited Dennis to the podcast, I was delighted that he replied saying, to say we're on the same page is somewhat of an understatement. Your title, Cannot Save Us, is the defining message in The Accountant's Apprentice and The Return of the Fifth Horseman in my planned trilogy. The same theme will be extended into the untitled third novel. I've since read The Accountant's Apprentice, a psychological thriller with unexplained murders and a protagonist filled with loss of faith and vulnerability. But there's more to it. Art is critical to his search for answers about truth, purpose, and human existence, and it's reviewed as a screaming success. I even share the same surname as the lead character, Justin Moore. If ever Can Art Save Us was to twin with an author, then I think this is very definitely it. Hello, Dennis, and welcome to Can Art Save Us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's lovely to have your time today, and I know how busy you are, so thank you again. Dennis, I wondered, in order to set the conversation up for listeners who may not yet be familiar with your work, if you could share the story outline of The Accountant's Apprentice, the first novel in the trilogy, and also the struggle you had with it to find what you call the inner spirit of the story.
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of starts out in a very personal experience or experiences. I had a friend, a colleague at the university where I teach. He was a Renaissance scholar and a Renaissance actor. He came down with Parkinson's disease and had to retire, and he moved up to Oregon to be with his daughter. And a couple of years later, I got a call from her, and she asked me if he came down, if she could get him down to San Diego, would I be willing to drive him around so he could see some of the old places that he and I used to go to together and things he loved, places he loved to be. And she added that I think it's probably the last time he will be able to make that trip. So, of course, I told her I would. So she got him down to San Diego, and I put his wheelchair in the back of my car and drove him to a variety of places. And along the way, a couple of things started to come together for me. I said, this is just really strange. This is a fellow that I knew very well. We talked about everything. For many years, probably 20 plus years. and I can't talk to him because he struggles to communicate. So as I'm pushing the wheelchair around, I'm just thinking there's something here, something I might be able to work on. And then the other thing I noticed too, that I hadn't seen in my car when I drove through these areas, and that was the burgeoning, growing homeless population in those areas. I started to kind of work on the story a little bit, and I tried a number of different ways of dealing with the experience and pulling things together, and it wasn't really quite coming together. But I heard of a place called the Evergreen Cemetery, which is our version of a potter's field, where the homeless are buried. And I decided to go out there and take a look and see what it was. So I drove out to that area, one of the poorer areas of San Diego. And I was passing still more homeless people, and I realized that population was growing. When I got to the Evergreen Cemetery, I noticed that there, to my right, there was this beautiful cemetery, big stones, faces on the stones, balloons, flowers, family members all around that area. A little bit farther in to my left, there were two rows of cypress trees, where the branches had been tied very tightly, almost a symbol of what I was going to see, which is lives that could never unfold and become anything really meaningful. So I got on my car and walked over there and looked out over what is a weed field, nothing but a weed field. And I decided to walk out into the middle of it. And when I got in the middle, I did see a one small cemetery stone. It said, "Never Forgotten." And I realized I was standing in the middle of those 10 acres of weeds. No cemetery markers. Many of the coffins were piled 2-3 deep. And I realized that was a fundamental question that I need to answer in the story. And that is to bring all this together with the spirit of this place. And I felt this is where I found the inner spirit. This is going to be a story about the homeless population. So when I started writing, and more seriously, The Accountant's Apprentice, I chose a narrator who was deeply troubled by something. He was living in isolation in a small studio apartment in downtown San Diego, close to downtown. And he spent most of his time, reading and twisting and turning a Rubik's Cube. We sense that he is a very troubled man, troubled by something that happened in his past. We don't know what it was, something he did or didn't do. And he's trying to get his life back together. So he answers an ad because he needs money to sustain his rather meager lifestyle. He sees a note in the foyer of his apartment, and it's a note that from an elderly man who is in a wheelchair and needs a driver to take him around San Diego. And the places he takes him to, or asks him to drive him to, seem to be just a disparate element of things. Some are old warehouses that appear to have drug activities outside. Then he also takes him to the Museum of Art, and he seems to be extremely knowledgeable about art and about things and historical occurrences that go all the way back to the Renaissance. And then Justin starts to think, maybe this fellow is an art thief of some kind. So all of these possibilities go through his mind, and he struggles to understand this guy and who he is and why he came into his life. And over time, he even begins to question whether AC comes from the biblical past or perhaps the historical past, and he's here on some kind of a mission. So a big part of the mystery here is, who is this guy? Why did he come into Justin's life? And he also kind of gets Justin to see the homeless situation that surrounds them in a very different way than Justin had seen them previously.
that's a really good way of setting the context and the position of the leads. Because as you mentioned, with the Rubik's Cube, this is very much a philosophical puzzle. There are many, many questions that we can ask ourselves. And I think your writing encourages us to ask ourselves. It's very significant, I think, that you wanted to consistently include the homeless community in this town, in this story, because it's really picking up on important themes around loss, around belonging, around having place, and even not having a place. So would you say that your main concern is how you want to try and bring these disparate elements together to find some sort of sense or cohesion as we try to do with our own lives?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's one of these projects that I've been involved with, the writing projects, where the minor characters, the homeless, gradually kind of come to the surface and become almost the story. Now, all of that was happening concurrently with things that were going on in San Diego. There were some very brutal beatings of some homeless people. One was lit on fire. One had railroad spikes driven into him. Wow. And you wonder, why? What is this? I also read some articles about the cause of homelessness. I read an article in Time magazine 2020, and they wrote that over four decades, $50 trillion was transferred from working Americans to multimillionaires. Over four decades, $50 trillion. And another statistic I came up with or found was, in 2022, the Global Wealth Data Bank indicated that in America, over one decade, the wealth grew by $80 trillion. $80 trillion. $60 trillion of those dollars went into the hands of the coffers of the top 10%. $60 trillion out of $80 trillion. So I started to look around a little bit more because I thought this is the book is a story. It's not an economic or sociological treatise, but all of this, I think, is involved. And I looked back in time and tried to ask the question very quickly, when was the last time that we had such income inequality in America? And then the year came up very quickly, 1928. We all know what happened in 1929. That was the stock market crash, followed by the Great Depression. And of course, that lasted for about 10 years. So I felt that what was going on had happened before, and it's probably starting to happen again. And I started going out and actually meeting with the homeless folks and talking to them. And I discovered it's income inequality. Some of the people who are not aware of this tend to see it as a character flaw or, you know, our desire to live like that, or perhaps it's drug addictions and all that comes in after they've been out the streets for a while and trying to survive. That's when the drugs tend to move into it. So I realized that this book has to somehow bring these folks to the attention of the people who read it. I became so taken by this issue that I went out and talked to them and got to meet them, bought one fellow a guitar and a ukulele. Turns out he was a musician who just had to go to the streets because he couldn't afford to live and pay the rent.
Yeah, and as you were saying, this is a deep and stark reality, and it certainly seems to only deepen and worsen. And I noticed that one of your articles for Psychology Today was also about courage and the homeless. You had an article that was called How Someone Who Is Homeless Can Teach Others the Meaning of Courage. And I wondered if you'd like to comment on that, because, of course, this also relates to the story world that you've created. I think you recognize courage, and I think you also attempt to afford respect back to people who are affected by homelessness.
Yes, I would like to comment on that, because, again, one of the things I wanted to do was to try to overcome all of these stereotypes that people have of the homeless, and to see them as human beings who are struggling for reasons that are way beyond their control. This fellow, frankly, was an inspiration to me. This was during the COVID epidemic, and I would drive from my home to school, the university. It's about a half hour drive, and I get to this one area, one park on the way. And I would always see him, I'll just use his first name, is Michael, dressed in this kind of poncho. He's a heavy set fellow. And he was always sitting on the small wall, and he was playing a little green ukulele. And people would gather, other homeless would gather below him, and they would listen to him play the ukulele. He was out there, found a little shelter in a bus stop with an overhang when it was raining. And I got to where he would build up my spirits during the COVID epidemic, because I thought, if you can do this under the conditions you're living, I certainly have to feel that I can do it. What I'm going through is nothing compared to what you're going through here. One night it was raining. I'll never forget this. And I left my home, and I just went for a drive to school, and I thought, I'm going to check in on him. And I drove past the area where he usually would be sitting, and he wasn't there. And I drove by a couple more times, and I still didn't see him. And I thought, well, good, he's found shelter somewhere. But then I noticed this kind of colorful something underneath a bus stop area where there's a roof, a little plastic roof overhead. And I drove by and I looked in, and there he was. He was he had his cartload of clothing, his water bottles hanging off the side. He was sitting there playing the ukulele in the middle of the rain, while the rain was dripping down on all sides of him. And I'll never forget that, because I think that, to me, was the ultimate strength of someone to live like that and to still play his music. Very, very deeply moving.
Yeah, and the courage to survive, and especially when you may well feel abandoned. Certainly in my experience of volunteer work in emergency homelessness shelters, I think it's a lesson that needs to be more widely understood, that homelessness is not actually very far away from most of us, whether that's economic difficulty. There's a phrase we often hear over here in the UK, at least, that most people are in trouble if there's just a 1 month paycheck that's suddenly missing. Obviously, we see displacement through wars. We have climate change threat and further displacement. I think homelessness is something that isn't far away from many of us. And I certainly encountered people that had had professional careers, mental health or clinical mental health issues had destroyed military careers, careers in the police. It had even led to abandonment from families, or even young women running from arranged marriages, for example. So I think I'm picking up on what you're saying, that there is a terrible dominant stereotype around people who are affected with homelessness, as though it is just a kind of careless, serves you right scenario.
I've had only one experience that even comes close to that kind of lifestyle. And that was when I was quite young. We were quite poor. We lived in an old farmhouse that had been hauled to town and put on some concrete blocks. And I remember my mother saying periodically that we might not be able to pay the rent next month. And as a boy, I thought, I was terrified. Where do we go? What do we do? That just kind of, I never forgot that. And that's nothing compared to what these folks have to do day after day after day. And the strength and the courage to do that. And I don't think people realize either how cold it is to be outside, even in San Diego, which is a very nice area to live in. You know, I have only had one experience like that. And that was when I camped outside and didn't, this was when I was a boy too, and didn't bring enough proper equipment. And I was just frozen that night. And I thought to myself, when I was watching Michael and the others trying to protect themselves, how unbelievably difficult that is. So, yeah. And that became the story. And that actually became even more of the story in the second one, The Return of the Fifth Horseman.
Yeah. And I was interested, Dennis, in also more of your personal story, as you just mentioned, in terms of your experiences growing up, and also the significance of your father's experience, which, of course, is particularly important in your book, Prairie Sun, and earlier when you were talking about income inequality and the Great Depression. I understand this is a particularly powerful story because your father was in fact adopted, but to be a farmhand rather than a son. And I think this was probably a very harsh experience. And I felt that really spoke again to issues of place, having a place, not having a place, belonging, having a sense of belonging or not having a sense of belonging. I wondered when you became aware of that story, whether that further informed how you grapple, if you like, with the idea of place in your writing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yes. That's kind of a long story. But when I was a boy, my parents were divorced. It was kind of a complicated thing. My mother came down with skin tuberculosis as a child. So she was one leg was 2 inches shorter than the other when her hip was basically destroyed. My father tried to make a living in that small town and couldn't do it. So he had to go to another town, Minneapolis, actually, to try to make a living with that. So he was kind of in and out of my life, a little bit of a mystery to me. What happened when I was probably about 9 or 10 years old, I guess, for the first time, someone stopped me on the streets and asked how my father was doing. And I told him, you know, I hear from him over the telephone, he calls, and he writes. I see him occasionally and everything. And he said, I don't know, they almost always add, I don't know if you know what your father's life was like on that farm where he was raised, but he was treated just terribly, just terribly. One fellow who owned a little gas station convenience store, every time I went in there, would pull me aside and start telling me about how my father was treated on that farm. Turns out he was friends with my dad when they were young, and so he knew a lot. He had a lot of inside information. When I got older, I started to take an interest in this story. My father was very ill. He came down with cancer. I was out to visit him in Houston, trying to help him out as best I could in the remaining months of his life. More of what happened to him in his youth came out, and I realized they'd kept him away from school. If he went to school, his adoptive father would come and pull him out after a couple hours and bring him back to the farm to work. I learned that if they were going fishing, he would have to stay home and work on the farm. And there were so many of these kinds of things I learned about him. And yeah, suddenly the mystery of my father was becoming, I think I see now who he is. And I spent 30 years, it's a very long story, 30 years really trying to figure out who he is and his life, and had some help from another adopted child in that area who turned out to be his very best friend, who contacted me and said, you have to write that story. So it's a long story, and it's kind of a wonderful story in a way, because I kind of completed his journey and connected with his birth parents on both sides, and still communicate with a half-sister he has who must be close to 100 years old. She invited me into her family, and she told me they're putting my father's name in the book that they were putting together, compiling of all of the Mosing descendants, ancestor going back with several generations. So it's been a very fulfilling kind of journey, and it's still going on.
Yeah, it's so significant, and the importance of how we all understand our own identities, our cultural identities, family heritage, the importance of roots. And as we've been saying throughout this conversation, the importance of place. And clearly your father showed immense courage in his life in order to survive that. And I'm equally interested, because of your lived experience and emphasis on small towns, and also as you grew up, seeing small towns disappear, there's perhaps a kind of insecurity or vulnerability that comes with that. And I wondered whether you felt that you are effectively honouring the importance of heritage. So as these small towns disappear, as people disappear, you're also honouring the importance of heritage.
I'm not sure I thought of it in those terms. I think it is true. I just kind of got pulled into the story. And once I got pulled into it, I couldn't stop. My hometown was very fortunate. It was a town of only 4,000 some people when I was there. But the University of Minnesota put a branch of the University of Minnesota right on the edge of town, where there was a Native American school that had kind of gone out of existence. So it became kind of a college town. However, my father lived on a farm 6 miles, well, it was actually about 6 miles away in a town called Alberta. That was probably 200 people. My grandmother, my mother lived in a town about 200 people. And so I'm really accustomed to small towns. And my wife and I, whenever we drove back to Minnesota, we would get off the main freeway and take all of the state highways and county roads, wherever we could go through the small towns. And what we would see everywhere on Main Street is half the shops closed. And it became a very kind of haunting experience to see this and to wonder how many of them are even going to survive for the next 10 years. It was sad, very sad. But that sense of a time that's passing, I think, worked itself into a number of things that I wrote. I wrote a book for Bantam Books called, the title was The Return, The Search for Judd McCarthy, and another one, The Sins of Rachel Sims. They're all set in small towns, and I wanted to get into those towns and bring those people to life, kind of the way I did with the trilogy. But in this case, it was the homeless populations, but in the other case, it was these small town characters and how they're struggling to create some kind of a life for themselves, even as they see the town disappearing right in front of them. That was I love writing about small towns.
Yeah, it's really significant how, it's such a strong setting, of course, throughout your work. And I also was curious whether it meant that when you yourself decided to move on, if you like, from a small town via studying, for example, whether that might have been seen as a radical act. Was that in some way disruptive for the small community in the small town where you had been growing up?
Well, one of the things that came to mind when you were just describing that is I made the decision when I left my small town that I would never look back. And I looked out the side mirror of my car as I was leaving, and I thought, I'm done. And then all I ended up doing was looking back and writing all of these things. I think that the people in my father's story, anyhow, were so good to him, so good. Many of them tried to intercede in his situation. They knew what he was going through, and they told his adoptive parents, you have to treat this boy better. You have to get him to a dentist. You have to let him go to school. He felt so little affection in his life that even a little pat on the back made a difference.
It's such a terrible story of child cruelty and neglect that he had to survive.
There's one story I'll tell you about that. I was on a book tour, and almost every stop in 12 cities back there, when I started talking about this, there was someone who would turn to a friend next. That could be my father's story, or that could be my mother's story. It was very, very common, much more than I thought it was, to adopt children and turn them into farm laborers. In fact, I learned later that there was a thing called the orphans train. I don't know if you ever heard of that, what happened. New Jersey orphanages and some in New York basically tried to empty out their orphanages by sending the children out west. They thought they were giving them a better life. As it turns out, in some cases, that was true. But there were, between 1859 and 1929, I think it was 350,000 children were sent out west to have the better life. And it turns out about one third of them ended up in the same kind of situation as my father, maybe not quite as bad.
But it is so absolutely shocking. And of course, this all speaks to, in other ways, your concerns around the homeless communities you've witnessed. There's a terrible sense of neglect. There's a terrible sense of abandonment and being forgotten. And so you're really drawing on such deep personal experiences in your family and stories, as well as what you witness in a contemporary setting, the social context of escalating poverty and homelessness, for example.
I think also it's in a tradition that I really, really appreciate in American literature. And that is, and I think part of the defense of the humanities. I believe as a group, we tend to be far more sympathetic towards people who are disadvantaged, who are marginalized. One writer that comes to mind immediately, not a very household name, maybe Stephen Crane, who wrote The Red Badge of Courage, but he saw how the people in New York were living in the slums. He decided to move in with them and to write about them and to bring to the surface what their lives were like and what this income disparity was doing. He died at the age of 29 from tuberculosis, from living in that kind of squalor. You know, you have John Steinbeck, the great depression. Everybody identifies with him. He went out and spent time and lived with the Okies, who were coming out to California from Oklahoma, and told their stories. So, you know, I'm just one person doing this, but I think one of the great advantages of the humanities and why we can't let them push us out of the universities is we tend, I think, to tell the stories of those kind of people. And those stories need to be told to overcome some terrible injustices that are you know, in almost every community, I suppose, every country.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, of course, is something else you do brilliantly well, particularly in this trilogy. Your work around how you include art or the arts versus, if you like, controlled thinking patterns in the modern world. It's very much about reminding us as readers how the arts can be vital door openers that speak truth, for example, or door openers onto other perspectives, other realities in the world. How would you describe the importance of the relationship AC has with the arts throughout that journey in The Accountant's Apprentice that sets this whole trilogy up?
Well, I think there's a quote by Bertolt Brecht that kind of tells me everything when I saw this. I don't have the exact words, but he basically said, and this is 1947, he said that first they come after the culture, then they come after the people. He was referring to fascism in his time, but he was also, I think, referring to the more universal sense of authoritarianism and what it does. In other words, once they remove the arts, then the people are vulnerable. I think A.C. is a character. Of course, he's kind of shrouded in mystery and ambiguity, which I think he has to be. But he's trying to get Justin to recognize, pardon me, that art has a very crucial role in society. In many respects, it keeps the forces of authoritarianism at bay for a time by teaching us to look at life in ways that the authoritarians never look at it. Everybody's disposable to them. And AC, as the title suggests, and it seems that he is setting up Justin as the accountant's apprentice. And then there is another possibility, and that is with a young girl and her mother who come in off the streets and live in a rescue shelter. And this little girl seems to have such artistic talents that she seems almost to be connected in some way to the Renaissance and the great Renaissance artists. And I think those artists told us, or tried to tell us through their paintings, and AC tries to tell us, that we have to re-examine the human form every so often. We have to ask ourselves, who are we? Where are we? What are we doing here? And I think in many respects, we're at that kind of a turning point again right now. I think with all of the technology coming our way and what it's kind of doing to us, taking over our lives and in many respects, taking over our thinking. I think AC ultimately is a character who almost sees the whole of human history and sees the artistic traditions that go way back and tries to bring them into the future and to allow them to help us see the future ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think it's worth looking at your particular choice, of course, of Renaissance art. And so in the first novel, there's that particular emphasis from AC to go to the museum. He wants to see the Renaissance art exhibition. And of course, the Renaissance is concerned with revival, rebirth, for example. It was a time where arts and sciences, or the great artists like Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, would equally embrace arts and science, whereas today's context feels very, very divisive. Would you think that's fair to say?
Yes, I do. I think that there's, almost been a war on art. Our universities, for example, have been pushing the humanities out the doors. There's a dwindling number of students who are majoring in any form of art, music, literature, what have you, and are, you know, majoring in business and technology of one kind or another. We have in our classrooms, we have the tech people taking over everything. We're dealing with AI writing, which is not AI, it's also AI thinking. We have cell phones that have become addictive. We have all of these things, and many, and well, they're telling us how to teach our courses, you know, through pull down menus. I just think that we are at a place where we have to somehow get back. And I'm not opposed to all science and all technology, not in any way. I mean, I'm open heart surgery. I know I'm glad they have that. It saved my wife's life. But I think we have to look at the past artistic traditions and see how they stood up really to the oligarchs and to the, you know, the monarchs of their time. And of course, if you want to learn about those folks, just read Shakespeare's plays, or better yet, go see them. We need that. We need that, those people in our lives again. And I think AC knows that.
Yes. And it feels that AC often has very significant statements to make and questions. So, for example, he says to Justin directly, "Art is the force that drives the universe. Did you know that?" He's actively asking Justin to consider that. And of course, Justin, who has been a priest, is surrounding himself with spiritual, philosophical, theological questions. And now AC is focusing him on the significance of art, or in this case, Renaissance art, the importance of revival, of rebirth, as you were saying, of being able to talk back, if you like, to answer back to what has gone before and to encourage openness. Whereas AI is asking us to continually transfer our own skills and our own authority to artificial intelligence.
Yes, absolutely. It's taking the thinking power away from us. That quote you read, incidentally, as I was listening to it, it may reflect something that Albert Einstein said. And of course, Einstein was a scientist, a brilliant, brilliant man. But he said, this is not an exact quote, but he said, "The imagination leads the way for all human progress." The imagination leads the way for all human progress. He wasn't discounting knowledge or saying that the imagination is all we need, but he was saying it leads the way. And if we discount the imagination and creative and imaginative thinking, which is what's happening in our universities, at least in this country, and I think elsewhere as well, then you are not going to have real progress, or at least you will have the wrong kind of progress. I think at some point, the technology, which has done some things, I don't want to go back or typing on a typewriter, for example. But at some point, it reaches the arc of dysfunctionalism, and it starts to create the very problems it set out to solve. And I think we're way past that point. We need to encourage students not only to do their own thinking, but to use their own imaginations to push ahead and determine their own lives and their own futures. You know, even Henry David Thoreau in Walden Pond, which of course is the ultimate expression of living a creative life, chapter two is on economics. And he admits, you know, we got to make a living, sure. But beyond that, we have to live. And as we live and use our imaginations, we, I think, develop the human race in a much, much more positive way than it is right now. Right now, we're in trouble. We're in a turning point. Whether we're going to go the right direction or the wrong direction, I'm not sure. Hopefully, it'll be the right direction.
Yeah, but as you say, it's a very, very critical time. And the article you referred to, which for listeners, you can also find in Psychology Today, "Dysfunctionalism. Is dysfunctionalism the new norm in modern life?" And you raise really significant points in terms of the bombardment of fast technology, the social media world, fragmented information, information we don't know if we can trust. All of that seems to almost function in a strategic way as a deliberate distraction. And I feel that one of the important things your books are doing, or specifically within this trilogy, is you're reminding us of the importance of art and also the art of curiosity.
I think so. And I'm seeing a little bit of a backlash in a good way, I think. I just picked up a University of Southern California brochure, and they're doing a Shakespeare program to examine Shakespeare's relevance to the world we live in right now. And I thought, good for you. That's exactly what we should be doing. I'm finding my students, especially in business, are starting to feel that they're not getting the kind of education that they should be getting. And I don't even call it business education. Maybe I'm a little hard there. I don't know. But I think it's more business training. They're being trained to fit into a certain cog in a corporate machine. They're starting to think very seriously about what they need to do to fill themselves out as human beings. Now, they're not all quite where I am, I'm sure, and they can't be expected to be. But they're starting to get that little feeling inside of them. I need to have something more. And I think that something more is to fill out their humanity. So I'm kind of encouraged a little bit by that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was curious, spanning your career within teaching, what you may be most concerned about in terms of what you saw in your students at the start of your career, who wouldn't have been as bombarded as we are today through technology, compared, of course, to the students you encounter now?
Well, there's a huge difference today. For example, in some ways, I think we've been reduced to cell phone monitors, and there have been a number of studies. The New York Times just published one about 2 weeks ago that indicated that the attention deficit issues that today's students have are almost catastrophic. I use the word catastrophic, and we see this all the time in the classroom. They struggle. It's an addiction. It is an addiction, and they can't put them down. So we have to somehow break them out of that. So I'm trying to find every kind of creative way I can think of in the classroom to get them to see that a lot of the kind of learning they're getting, which is, I think, pretty, you know, of the type that I'm kind of parodying on my T-shirt, is not real learning. Real learning is creative learning, is creative teaching. And they're reacting very well to it. I'm doing different film versions of Shakespeare's plays, for example, and we talk about them, and they can see the art, the creativity. They can see the kind of people that Shakespeare warned us to avoid in our society, which we're seeing all around us at, you know, various levels. I think there's hope. I do. And I hope I'm right.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, of course, in terms of the trilogy, you have said that it originally felt like you were writing about a dystopian future. It could be the collapse, if you like, of the natural world, the climate crisis. You make specific references to bees, the significance of bees within the Accountant's Apprentice. It's a reminder of potential collapse. We could talk about the collapse of arts and humanities in the education system. But you also said it actually felt more like a chronicle of our times.
Yeah, it did. Actually, I thought when I first was started the trilogy with The Accountant's Apprentice, I thought I was extending things into the future a ways. And the homeless situation, as it kept growing and growing and growing, seemed like I was living in a dystopian world, in the dystopian present. And that kind of grew over time. And then I saw the breakdown in our educational system. I saw AI come out and do not just the writing for us, but the thinking for us. I mean, that's just incredible that we would ever allow something like that to happen. Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, for example, creates, some futuristic world in which you have a one-world government, you have selective breeding, you have all kinds of ways to create a master class, but then everybody else is kind of, less educated and less capable of doing serious things. And suddenly, I'm in the middle of this. This is where I am. And that's kind of, I think, where we are. And we have to now claw our way back out.
Yeah, and I felt this was really interesting in terms of how you embrace prophecy, if you like, in these stories, again, within this trilogy. It feels like, again, the significance of how you embrace the arts as part of this story world is a way of, as you said earlier, actually checking the past and checking the future. But are you also trying to encourage readers to consider not only the idea of prophecy, but perhaps the prophecy of their own lives, the ownership of their own lives and their own minds?
Oh, I think so. The Fifth Horseman, Justin becomes even more fascinated by different prophecies. One is the prophecy of Edgar Cayce, the sleeping prophet, who seems to have been right in so many of his prophecies. And he prophesies that the human race, I think he said there's five stages. We started out as a purely spiritual entity, went through an excessively materialistic entity, and now we're going back to the spiritual. Maybe he's right. Nostradamus, of course, predicted two of our megalomaniacs, Napoleon and Hitler, and predicted that there was another one that we'd be seeing in the early part of this century, actually in this decade. And I think there's ample evidence that they're out there. So there is that, yeah. I think that it's important. I had a professor, David Noble, University of Minnesota. He used to say, just look for the patterns of history. Don't just think of history as something that is a little something that happens at this time and this time and this time. Look for the patterns in the past and use them to develop your own view of life. And if we have more people who do that, I don't think they will fall victim to the false prophets that we see all around us today. So I think it starts with kind of renewing and reinvesting in your own sense of life and how you interpret the events around you. And it kind of works outward, and then it is resonated in our institutions, in our educational systems. We need more of that. And the liberal arts and the humanities do that. That's why I'm so strongly in favor of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it feels to me that your writing is helping us to focus on how humanity is broken. And one example of that, of course, is if we look at the neglect of people who are affected by homelessness or perhaps child neglect, for example. And at the same time, you're also working with the arts, perhaps as a positive reminder that there is a space and there is a way to cultivate a different and better, kinder, equal, happier humanity. So, for example, AC is a gifted artist. And I really like how early on in the first novel, The Accountant's Apprentice, we notice AC draw homeless people that he encounters. And it's a very meditative opportunity as he's reflecting on those people or perhaps the condition of their lives. And the skills involved in his drawing ability also feels like he's returning and affording some respect to those people. Would you say that you are encouraging people to think again about the arts as a new space, meditative space, to try and recover the world that we wish we lived in?
Absolutely. I think, you know, everybody should have a creative life as in addition to whatever they have to do to make a living. But I also think just the act of creating art, watching art, it pulls us into the deepest part of ourselves. It pulls us into the deepest part of our humanity. It pulls us into a place where we can empathize with people we otherwise would not even recognize as being on the same species as we are. It really stands as a barrier of sorts to, well, not a barrier, but it's a way of taking all the technology that's coming at us and putting that human element back into it. And we need that. We desperately need that. And both in the personal level and the professional level, and what we're doing right now, talking about it, all of those things.
Yes, which of course is such a great example of why the arts are important and literature is important. You've created an experience that creates conversations, and we now have someone in the UK talking to someone in the USA. It's an incredible connection. It's testimony to the power of that connection and that willingness to be open to each other, to explore these different ideas. And of course, another favorite statement of mine that AC makes in the first novel is, the imagination leads the way for all human progress. Is that what we might witness in the third book, in the third novel of the trilogy, once it's written?
Yes. And I guess I can give a little bit away. This girl, this young girl and her mother, who are on the streets and come to the shelter, and Justin decides to take them in, at least for a time. And he leaves his Rubik's Cube at the girl, and he goes back and does some work, and later on that night he comes back and he finds that, in fact, it's been solved. And we also see some of her drawings, and there's a realization there that this girl is an artistic savant of some kind. So through the course of the next part of the trilogy, as I said earlier, the homeless take even a deeper sense in the story. And this young girl comes of age and tries to use her artistic skills to really show their humanity. And she puts her little crayon drawings on the wall, and they come and stare at them and look at them and wonder if this is what they might have been if things had gone a little differently. So there's she becomes kind of the center of the story in a way. And the last one, which we're working on right now, should be done, I think, in about June or July, hopefully. I'll give you just a little bit about it. She's starting to take a little bit of an interest in Shakespeare and the connections between Shakespeare and Michelangelo and the other Renaissance folks that have been pushed off the university educational charts. And so she becomes, I think, over time, a bit of the new spirit that may and hopefully will emerge that recognizes the importance of all the humanities, for that matter. And I'm hoping that we can get the folks that who run our schools, provide funding for our schools, start to reconsider the importance of these things. So I started out to write a very different kind of story, but it's kind of taking on a life of itself, I think.
Yeah, which must, of course, always be part of the pleasure and pain, perhaps, of being a writer. And of course, that feeds into the series question, unfortunately, we've raced through our hour. But how would you respond, Dennis, to the series question, can art save us?
I think it has to save us. I believe the future that we are looking at right now, that we're almost in the middle of, is more of the one that Brecht, Huxley, and others like them saw coming. And unless we allow art to have a stronger role and to put up kind of a protective barrier against the less admirable parts of technology and science, I think the future will be virtually unlivable. So art, I believe, kind of creates a spirit that needs to be infused into everything that's going on in our classrooms, on the streets, all of that. If it's not, I think we'll be in deep trouble. But I'm hoping that the spirit that's I feel coming alive again, I've expressed earlier, I'm hoping that continues, especially in our classrooms, but elsewhere as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I just think it's incredibly admirable what you're doing, both as a teacher, an educator, and a writer, that you're encouraging people through your work to perhaps discover for the first time or rediscover why the arts and humanities are so important, and through the journeys you're characters take and undertake, the struggles that they have to survive and negotiate. You're offering a very interesting perspective in terms of how the arts and humanities help us navigate our lives and in ways that are happier and fairer for all of us. I will be signing on your episode page. I'll signpost for the listeners where they can find more of your work, and hopefully they can explore your writing for themselves. But I would like to say a very, very big thank you to you, Dennis, for your generosity and your time for joining me today.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, questions were wonderful. Thank you so much.
I'm pleased to hear it. I have to admit, I was very concerned. I might feel like a very inadequate student after all your years in teaching.
Oh, no. They were perfect. They were wonderful. Thank you so much. And really, we are kindred spirits. I sense that right away, too. So I'm hoping there are people who can learn from this and, you know, maybe make some changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully our paths will perhaps even cross one day, because as I said in my introduction, if ever myself or Cannot Save Us was to be twinned with an author, then I definitely think this is it.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Dennis.
You're more than welcome.